the cycling podcast in association with Rafa. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freiba.
Hello, Richard.
Sorry, I stumbled over that a little bit, Daniel. Do accept my apologies. Here we are with another cycling podcast, and this one is a little bit different. We've got an extended interview in this one with a rider that you may never have heard of, but who has a fascinating story to tell. And we'll have a little discussion before we hear that about a part of professional cycling that you also may not be too familiar with. Before we crack on with that, Lionel, have you got a news roundup, please?
I have indeed, Richard, yeah. One of the big stories that's rumbling on and will probably rumble on for another few weeks is the future of Wout van Aert, the world cyclocross champion and prodigious up-and-coming classics talent who rode for Verandas Willems this season. In the summer, there was all sorts of shenanigans going on with the Aqua Blue Sport team suggesting that there was a merger on the cards. Wout van Aert said he didn't know anything about that, and his future is really up in the air because he actually has a contract with Lotto NL Jumbo, who will become Team Jumbo next year, but the contract doesn't start until the start of the 2020 season. He was supposed to ride next season with Verandas Willems, but he wants to get out of that, and there's a bit of a tug of war going on at the moment because Sniper Cycling, the company that owns the Verandas Willems team, wants financial compensation to allow Van Aert to join Lotto NL Jumbo a year early. So Van Aert at the moment is racing cyclocross World Cup races in an unsponsored rainbow jersey, and it's all a bit unclear what will happen. He's obviously had a decent season on the road. He was third at Strade Bianche, ninth at the Tour of Flanders, 13th at Paris-Roubaix, third at the European Road Race Championships in Glasgow, and won the Tour of Denmark as well in August. But at the moment, we can't say for certain who he'll be racing for next season, or whether he'll even be racing on the road, because he actually joked that he would take a year's sabbatical if it wasn't sorted out soon. Can't believe that that will be the case.
Lionel, sorry to interrupt your news roundup, but do you recall, we talk at the moment about a sort of crisis in sponsorship and cycling, but these things happen all the time, and there was one in Britain in around about the early 90s, and there were quite a lot of riders who rode on their own as sort of independents. And I think going back, there have been other periods in the history of the sport where that's been the case. Do you remember that? You're old enough to remember that. Not sure Daniel is.
I remember the Zero Boys in about 1986, and Neil Stevens, the Australian who later rode for Festina, was a member of the Zero Boys. They were a bunch of unsponsored riders in Belgium who managed to get an invite to some semi-classics and just rode in plainish jerseys. But I can't see Wout van Aert.
And in the UK, there was Dave Mann, who became known as the Man in Black, who dominated the criteriums, having lost his contract, lost his team.
Well, I can't see Wout van Aert turning up at the Tour of Flanders in a team of one, can you? I'm not sure that the UCI will allow that to happen. Speaking of the UCI, the president, David Lapartion, has suggested that ASO are considering a women's Paris-Roubaix and a 10-day women's Tour de France. Now, he's been on the interview circuit in the last week or so. He's over in London for the Ruler Classic. Quite surprised that he was seemingly talking on behalf of ASO there, but if those two events were to come to fruition, that would be nothing but good news. He also says that he expects the ban on tramadol to be in place at the start of the 2019 season, and he wants the UCI to come into line with the Movement for Credible Cycling's rules on corticosteroids. That would mean that riders would not be able to use cortisone in races, even with a TUE, a therapeutic use exemption. We've talked about this issue a lot over the last couple of years. The stumbling block was thought to be that the UCI couldn't adopt rules that were over and above the World Anti-Doping Agency's code, but they clearly want to do that with regard to tramadol and cortisone, so we shall watch and see. I mean, January the 1st is quite soon, so they've not got long to get these rules into place if that's what they're doing. The Belgians have named Yves Lampaert and Sana Kant as the Flandrians of the year. Lampaert, of course, the Belgian champion, and Sana Kant twice world cyclocross champion. Quite a prestigious award, this, in Belgium. And it surprised me that only three Quickstep riders have won it, Lampaert being the third. Paolo Bettini and Tom Boonen are the other two in the history of that award. A little bit of news regarding Roger Hammond. He has been a sports director at Dimension Data, but he's dropping down. A bit unfair perhaps to say that, but it's true. He's going to go back to the Madison Genesis team here in the UK. A little bit surprised about that, because I thought that Hammond and Mark Cavendish got on very well and worked very well together. So a little bit surprised that Hammond is leaving Dimension Data. And finally, some very sad news. Australian former professional Jonathan Cantwell has died at the age of 36. He was an Australian national criterium champion. He rode a couple of years for the Saxo Bank team, finished the Tour de France in 137th place for them in 2012. He retired at the end of 2014, and last year he had successful treatment for testicular cancer, but very sad news that he has passed away.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thank you very much indeed to our headline sponsor, Rafa. I'm kind of nervous about naming any products this week, because every time I do, I get accused of sort of putting in a plea for said product.
That's because you are putting in a plea.
I did a couple of weeks ago, admittedly. Somebody called Neil Oakes tweeted, say, just listen to Cycling Podcast. He directed this at Rafa. Could you send Lionel Burney and Freeboss an Explorer jacket? Leave out the other bloke. That's nice. Thank you, Neil, for that. Don't listen to him, Rafa. I will mention this week the just relaunched Tweed Softshell jacket. After last week's tartan takeover of the Cycling Podcast, which I only realised after it was released, this obviously has a jacket inspired by and made in Scotland. So the Tweed Softshell jacket, which first came out in 2008, has just been redesigned, relaunched, and it's available for your winter riding. Now, Lionel, you're finally going to tell us about our new spin-off series.
I can do, Rich. Yeah, what would you like to know?
I'd like to know everything. Well, it's called Explore.
It is.
And it launches next week.
It does, next Friday, November the 16th, the first of a six-part series. The episode will be released each Friday in the run-up to Christmas. It's called Explore. And, we're looking at all manner of endurance and ultra-endurance cycling, record-breaking rides, people who've ridden around the world, people who've ridden from end to end of Great Britain, people who've ridden across Europe.
People who've ridden from Cambridge to Southwold.
A couple of people who rode from Cambridge to Southwold and back. Yeah, well, I'm trying to make sure that the entire series is inclusive, not exclusive. There are some incredible feats that we will talk to people about, mind-boggling distances and mind-boggling challenges. But I wanted to make sure that the series as a whole appeals to as many people as possible. And basically, it's about riding a bike and seeing the world and setting challenges for yourself. Now, for some people, it might be a real challenge, a sort of challenge of a lifetime to ride a Gran Fondo or something like the Étape or the Tour of Flanders Sportive or one of those kind of events. For others, trying to ride around the world is what floats their boat. So it's pretty broad in its reach, but each episode has some really strong and fantastic stories told by some very compelling voices. So episode one will be focusing on the transcontinental race, and that will be out on Friday the 16th of November.
So each episode will have a theme, will it?
Loosely, yeah. I mean, we don't want to straitjacket ourselves. You know, that's the beauty of cycling, isn't it? You can turn left or turn right or go straight on or turn round and go back home. We're not kind of straitjacketing ourselves. We're leaving it quite footloose and fancy free.
So as I said at the start, in this week's episode, we are going to hear an interview with a rider that you might not know too much about, but you will probably recognise his name. It's Freddy Ovette, the son of Steve Ovette, a very famous runner from the 70s and 80s, Olympic champion in 1980 in Moscow in the 800 metres, a really great race. I rewatched that today. Lionel, I sent you the clip. Don't know if you watched it.
Yeah, I watched it, yeah.
Brought back some memories.
If Steve Ovette was a a sprinter, I think he'd have been disqualified for a couple of those elbow moves.
It was incredibly physical, wasn't it?
Yeah, he muscled his way out of some... but that was what was kind of appealing. You know, Steve Yvette never went the easy way. He always went the long way round, or he came from the back, or he was in difficulty and everything. He was brilliant in spite of a lot of things sort of holding him back. Well, the fact that there were these three great middle distance runners in the 80s, Coe and Yvette came just before Steve Cram. When there was an awful lot of athletics on the TV here in the UK at that time, you could almost define what you got from sport by which of the three you preferred. And I was always Steve Yvette fan, just because he was contrary, he was difficult. He did have to scrap and fight.
The Lionel Burney of the track.
Yeah, I was going to say, that sounds most incongruous, you going for the more difficult, mercurial one of the two.
What about you, Daniel? Well, what about you? You too young?
Very much too young, and I'll tell you exactly how young I was. I was apparently, according to my parents, born at the moment, or during pretty much, Sebastian Coe's victory over in the 1980s.
In the 1500 metres then?
Right. 1500 metres.
So you weren't even born for the 800 metres.
Oh, did the 800 metres come after? No, I wasn't then. So
no, the 800 metres was first, then the 1500.
So my allegiance should lie with Sebastian Coe. However, I've always felt more drawn to what I've heard about Steve Yvette.
Yeah, the rivalry between them was just what you want from sport. They were total opposites, weren't they? And they hardly ever raced against each other. Coe had an Yvette avoidance clause in his contracts for races, and Yvette seemed keener to race against Coe than the other way around. The other thing about Yvette was he refused to speak to the press. And in Moscow, he would make a gesture with his fingers after every race towards the cameras, and nobody knew what he was saying. He was tracing a heart and "I love you" to his girlfriend, which is very nice. But nobody knew what he was saying because he refused to speak to the journalists who were there, allegedly. It was great. And as you say, Lionel, it was a real golden era of athletics in the UK. We haven't become the athletics podcast here, but everybody of a certain age has very nostalgic kind of memories of that period. I was probably more of a Steve Cram fan, if I'm honest, when he emerged in 84. Very elegant runner, wasn't he, Steve Cram?
Very upright, yeah.
As was Coe, but yeah, Cram was very sort of upright and graceful and had long legs and looked very stylish. And it was a great time to follow that sport. Steve Yvette's son, Freddie, is very different, I think, to his father. Very open and a very interesting chap who I first became aware of about 3 years ago when he joined the AG2R development team. He himself had been a very promising runner, obviously. Following in his father's footsteps wasn't easy. He was born in Scotland, but grew up in Australia. He won the Pan Pacific 800 metre title, and then he became he got an athletic scholarship to the University of Oregon, which obviously has a very famous athletics program. He got a knee injury then and took up cycling. Weirdly, his father, Steve, was a cyclist too after he retired as a runner. And I remember when he lived in southern Scotland, he used to take part in club time trials and 10-mile time trials and so on, and that obviously created quite a stir whenever he showed up. He has a nasty crash on his bike at one point as well. Freddie took up cycling, obviously with some success. He was signed to AG2R's development team initially. I remember speaking to Dave Brailsford, and he said that he was watching him with some interest. You know, one of these guys who came to the sport quite late. He's 24 now and has had a few years in different development teams, but hasn't yet turned pro. And he had an opportunity this autumn as a stagiaire with the BMC team. Had some mixed fortunes during that period. We'll hear him talk about that in the interview. But it also shines a bit of a light, his interview, on the whole stagiaire system, because it's a sort of, it's a trainee program, I suppose, for young riders who are given an opportunity with World Tour teams towards the end of a season. And, you know, you don't often hear an awful lot about those riders while they are stagiaires. They're asked to do a job for a team, and as I say, they're on probation. But Lionel, you've been digging into the whole stagiaire system a bit, haven't you? And you've got some facts and figures about just how many riders get these opportunities and how many of them manage to convert them into professional contracts.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's. I was going to ask Daniel just for a kind of a summary of what the word stagiaire means, and I can then maybe talk about how the system actually works. But it is basically work experience, an internship, isn't it, Daniel?
Yeah, it is. It's a French word, which sort of the definition of which falls somewhere in between, well, T-boy, work experience boy, and apprentice. Usually, when it refers to normal jobs and normal professional world, it's unpaid. And yeah, it's become a commonly used word in cycling, whatever language you're speaking. You use the French word stagiaire, and a stage is the actual apprenticeship itself.
Well, each World Tour team has the option to take on 3 stagiaire riders from August the 1st up to the end of the season. Those riders can't actually race in World Tour ranked events, so they'd have to race in the smaller events, but it gives them an opportunity to see what the pro ranks are like, and it gives the teams an opportunity to observe them. Daniel, when we were talking just a bit before, you were making the point that riders on a stagiaire could fall into different categories. It might be just monitoring, keeping an eye on them for a couple of years down the line. Others may already have a contract with that team for the following year, and it's just a way to introduce them, give them a bit of time in the team, get to know some of the teammates and so on. But you also sort of pointed out how few of the sort of real top riders actually go through the stagiaire system. A lot of the obvious talents probably get signed up having got onto the radar of the top teams and don't need to necessarily go through the stagiaire sort of system for a few months. But looking back at the last few years, I picked 2013 just because, well, it's 5 years ago, and I had a look at all of the World Tour stagiaire riders, and it's quite interesting to note that of the 28 who were taken on and given a trial by a World Tour team in 2013, 10 of them will be racing either for a World Tour team or for a very high level pro continental team, so a team that would get a wild card at a Grand Tour next year. And that might be 11 because Stig Brooks also rode as a stagiaire that year, and he may well still have been in the pro ranks had he not had that absolutely terrible crash a couple of years ago. But some of the names from 2013 that leap out at me: Pierre Latour at AG2R, Sylvain Dillier, a stage winner at the Giro a couple of years ago, Valerio Conti.
Also, Lionel, I can just put in, Sylvain Dillier was a very rare rider to win a pro race while he was riding as a stagiaire. I think he won a stage of the Tour of Alberta when he was a stagiaire.
That is correct, yeah, that is correct. Valerio Conti as well, with Lamprey, who are now UAE Team Emirates. So, you know, 1 in 3 making it and staying in the pro ranks, I think, is a pretty high strike rate. And that kind of bears out, you know, dips a little bit, rises a little bit from 2014 through. Obviously, the riders who were stagiaires in 2016, 2017 and this year, we don't yet know how they're going to turn out. But of the riders who rode as a stagiaire this late summer and autumn, again, just over a third of them have got a contract with a World Tour team for next season. Freddy Ovett is one of those who hasn't. He rode as a stagiaire with BMC Racing. BMC Racing, of course, are becoming CCC after the merger / takeover with the Polish team. Still hoping to that something will come out of that. But you look at the way that the teams have used the stagiaire system over the years. There are some teams that really make use of it. Notably, AG2R and FDJ, or Groupama FDJ, as they are now, almost every year will take on 3 riders and have a look at them. And most years, somebody will get a pro contract out of that. And then at the other end of the spectrum, it's quite rare for Sky, very rare for Movistar and one or two other teams to even bother with the stagiaire process. Theo Gegenhardt, perhaps the exception that proves the rule with Team Sky. So it's kind of a, like I say, work experience, but there have been some illustrious names that have come through this system in recent years. Fernando Gaviria, Dylan Teuns, you know, Tish Benoit.
Who can forget Geraint Thomas's famous experience at Saunier de Val in 2006, Lionel? You know, would he ever have won the Tour de France if he hadn't had those? I don't know if he ever even raced for them, but officially he was a stagiaire for Sony and Duval in 2006.
I need to look this up. It was basically a disastrous one-day race. We may have to have a live corrections corner in here.
Can you find a picture? I want to see a picture of him in Sonny Duval kit.
you look that up, Lionel. Can I ask, did Geraint Thomasson did he have two stagiaire gigs? Because he was at T-Mobile as well with Ed Clancy and Mark Cavendish.
He was not at T-Mobile as a stagiaire, I don't think. I think he was at Wiesenhof. He rode for a T-Mobile sort of development program with Mark Cavendish, but I think only in smaller races, in sort of UCI 2.2 races, didn't, strictly speaking, qualify as a stagiaire. Although, Rich, now I'm saying this, I do have some recollection of him riding a Tour of Britain for T-Mobile.
I'm not sure about that, but just to another, and this is something that Freddie Ovette will be hoping happens for him, but just because it doesn't work out the first time you have a go at being a stagiaire, it can happen down the tracks. That your interview, Lionel, with Nick Schultz at the Vuelta was interesting. He did a stagiaire stint with Orica Scott a few years ago, and nothing came of it immediately. He has gone on to Pro Continental teams, but he is turning professional with Mitchelton Scott, the same team, next year. So there's been a gap between his stagiaire experience with them and turning pro with them, but that's not turning pro because he's been a professional, but joining the World Tour team next year. So
yeah, I made a kilometre zero about Nick Schultz at the Vuelta. Richard, it was actually your idea, that episode, and it worked out very well, and he talked about how he was offered the stagiaire place but knew that there wouldn't be a contract. There wasn't a spot on the team available for the following year, so it's very much that really was kind of work experience rather than immediately looking to convert that experience into a contract in the short term. So it can work in for different riders in different ways, and I'm still searching for evidence of Geraint Thomas's appearance for Saunier Duval.
Well, why don't we hear from Freddie Ovette, and then you can give us the true story about Geraint Thomas and Saunier Duval at the end.
Why not?
Or even better, I can ask Geraint Thomas because I'm meeting him tomorrow and we can hear about that in next week's episode. Shall we hear from Freddie Ovette? We will hear about his experience as a stagiaire and how, he was put in the picture quite early on about the prospects of getting a contract with CCC next year. It's really interesting in terms of some of the things I hadn't really considered about joining a team mid-season and riding a new bike with new kit, etc. And we'll hear also about his own life story, growing up as Steve Ovette's son, as a runner, and then becoming a cyclist, some of the challenges that those have brought for him. So let's hear from Freddie Ovette. Here he is.
I'm a guy that is pretty impatient, to be honest. And this whole year I've been pressing my agent, Robbie Hunter, to not only find me something for next year, but hopefully find a stage year opportunity. And that always was the idea with another World Tour team, that it was almost certain that I was going to stage year with a particular World Tour team. And then for whatever reason, that kind of fizzled out. Because of I got the stage year at the time of Qinghai Lake, everyone thought that those results was the reason that I got a stage year at BMC, but it was actually a done deal before the big results at stage year. It was during Qinghai Lake, but not before the stages that I did well on. So yeah, I think Robbie was at the tour at the time and he was just pressing people's buttons. Jim Ockwitz, one of them, and Jim gave me a shot and it was huge at the time. It was exciting. BMC has a massive connection with Australians, so that was promising as well for the following years, even with the change to CCC. And so I was excited for that about for a day and thought, great, and then Robbie got in touch again the next day and said, look, this is getting difficult now because Alan really wants you to go to Utah. I remember I looked at the dates for Utah the day before and I knew right away. I was like, Robbie, you do know that Utah starts like 2 days after Qinghai finishes. He's like, yeah, if we decide to do it, you can't finish Qinghai Lake. And I was like, I've been working for this race for like 3 months. It's 2.HC. There's not many guys from my position that have finished in the top 10 at Qinghai Lake. It's usually Colombians and Venezuelans and all these guys from altitude-based areas. And, I was really proud of that result and proud of how I was feeling. And So yeah, it was like bittersweet. We decided that I was going to stop Qinghai Lake, which I did. I was able to race two or three more stages, which I really made the most of, and went in the breakaway and did all sorts of silly things, you know, just to enjoy it and make the most of it. And I went across, and I went across to Utah, and I had 5 days there before the race, and I just, it's funny, when you're on form and you're riding well, you really just forget about the little things, and jet lag, new bike, new seat, wrong measurements, getting sick upon arrival, new team, new atmosphere, having everything done for you. It was a major shock, and I handled that pretty poorly, I think, to be honest. And the first day I was terrible. I rode on the front for as long as I could, but the bike was wrong, and I was, it was bad, and I was like, oh god, this is not good. Obviously TJ was leading, so we had a responsibility. Next day I sort of came good, you know, we adjusted the bike, sickness was sort of on the way to out. I think I was in the second group on a pretty hard day, and you know, after doing a lot of work, so I was like, okay, I'm coming round. And I think it was the third stage. It was a really hectic first 2 hours of the race with the breakaways. It was one of those typical stages where everyone sits down in the bus beforehand and they say, today's the day for the breakaway, the breakaway is going to stick. And what everyone else has realized is that every other fucking bus is having the same conversation. So yeah, for 2 hours the breakaway didn't go, and when it was just about to be formed, I was actually in a group that was coming across to it, and someone hit me really hard from behind. I'm not too sure what happened, and I hit the ground at 60k an hour and just completely did a really, really bad job of, yeah, removing a lot of skin and doing a lot of damage that I'm still recovering from sort of 6 weeks later. And that was my race done, like, you know, so that was hard. And then since then I had 2 weeks back here, you know, dealing with the wounds every day, and they were bad, they were sort of infected and deep. And but then the team was like, you know, we're going to put you into a Germany, it's a great race for you. And I'm like, oh, okay, good, you know, another opportunity, you know, train quite hard, you know, to try and sort of prove to yourself, now you're all right. Got sick before leaving for Tour of Germany, so I got sick twice in 2 weeks, which I think speaks volumes of the stress that I was under. And went to Germany and was useless there again because I had a chest infection, and came back from that. Really wanted to touch base with Alan, and Alan called me up, I think the day I arrived back, and said, look Freddie, I don't sort of base this on your recent races, because we understand, you know, you've gone through a tough time, but there's not going to be any room for you next year. And I was like, that's a difficult 3 weeks. You know, not only did I have a crash and sickness and that news, I also gave up a ninth place on GC at a 2.HC race in order to give this whole thing a chance. And yeah, I don't want to sound hard done by, but that is the reality of it. You know, when you look at pro cycling stats, when teams look at pro cycling stats, they see Freddie Ovett DNF Qinghai Lake, when everyone knows fully that I would have finished off the job there. And
what you described there is a sequence of major events where you're parachuted into a really established team, even putting on kit that's very familiar to you and adjusting to being a BMC rider. What is there any kind of support for that? Is there any, you know, are you eased in any way? Are you briefed about what's expected and what your job is? Or are you expected to just sort of slot into this pretty well-oiled machine?
Look, BMC were great, you know, in terms of the Jackson Stewart at Utah and TJ, and all of them were so welcoming and nice. And I was surprised that I thought they would be a bit of a boys' club. And, you know, and I have heard in previous years on other teams that, you know, stages are kind of treated as stages. You know, the new guy, you're the new kid, you do this, you do that. And you know, they were super respectful, and the staff treated me like any other rider. They're like, okay, this kid's obviously good enough. He's got here for a reason. You know, whatever you need help with, your bike and whatever. And they were great, because, you know, obviously I was having bike issues and they were on it. You know, they were talking about it at the dinner table and working it out. So that was good. And I have to commend BMC for that. And Germany was also amazing. Germany was amazing at the dinner and breakfast table, and I remember Caruso and Loic Vliegen saying, like, we haven't had an atmosphere like this at a race all year. And I was like, fuck, that's cool, you know, that we can sit after dinner and say stories for an hour or so. And even though the race is going terribly, you know, you really value things like that, you know. But yeah, it is odd, you know, like a BMC suitcase sort of wheeled into your hotel room and kidding up for a ride the next day and looking in the mirror and being like, fuck, you know, like, this is odd. But then that's it. Like, you know, you go on the training ride, you sit at the coffee shop with the rest of them, you go back, you have lunch, you shower, and that's it. That's your reality all of a sudden. And, you know, you better not act strangely about it. Otherwise, you know, everyone else is going to be thinking, you know, come on, mate, like, get real. But
I mean, Alan Piper telling you that there wouldn't be a contract and telling you it didn't have anything to do with what happened in Utah and Germany, I guess in your mind, though, it's very difficult to unentangle those events, you know, that you think that if everything had gone really well in Utah and Germany, things might have been different.
I think definitely. I think if I went to Utah and did an amazing job, finished top 10 and helped TJ, I think I would have got signed. And that is fully what Robbie Hunter and I both knew. Robbie said, you have to go to Utah and do a good job, whether that's being the last guy on the climb to help TJ or whether that's getting a stage result. We both fully knew that. And he said, never did Robbie say, yeah, look, you know, you're going to get signed by CCC. It was kind of the opposite. It's like, you need to do something to get signed. And then because of all the variables that impacted my performance, it was like, yeah, once I crashed out, it's like, oh, well, there goes that opportunity. You know, there goes an altitude race that has a really good final weekend of climbing. That, you know, that was really hard to take. And then Piper saying, look, you know, like, full credit to Piper. And then I've heard a lot of stories of stages being told in like November, now we're not going to take you on. So that it's good of him to let me know that early and not sort of mess me around. But also, it was an opportunity that I tried to grasp, but I couldn't because of a lot of things. And maybe that was my fault, not appreciating how much of a big thing it was to take on traveling from America to China to Utah.
Can I go right back? Yeah. Who is Freddie Ovett? I mean, you were born in Scotland, weren't you?
Yeah.
Born in Dumfries, sure, is that right?
I was born in Dumfries. I've got a sort of bizarre background, really. Obviously, you know, the history of my dad. But yeah, I was born in Scotland. I lived there for 7 years. Long story short, parents went to Australia quite a few times when dad was running and for their honeymoon, and loved it. Scotland, as you know, is great, but it's a difficult place to bring up sort of outdoorsy sort of kids. And they made the big decision to move over to Australia, which was huge. And yeah, I grew up in an Australian sort of way of life, which is we live on the beach basically, and I was just out all day doing sports, swimming, triathlon, running, cricket, everything. And it was quite apparent very on that I was very good at endurance sports, running in particular. And I was very good. I was sort of national junior champion, Pan Pacific champion on the track. And from an early age, 10 years old, I was like, oh, this is what I'm going to be one of the best runners in the world at one stage. And I'm putting everything into that. I think I was the most professional 10, 11 year old, way too serious. Just, yeah. And that was successful for a while. And then, you know, I went through a maturity phase and sort of my legs weren't sort of everything was kind of out of kilter. I was like a Bambi sort of thing, you know, and I was trying to compete with the best, and it was difficult at times. Anyways, yeah, I got through school, did well with that, and then I went to the University of Oregon on sort of a scholarship sort of deal there. Obviously, Oregon has got a massive sort of history with running, and that was a big deal for me. That was going great. And so I got an injury. This is the standard sort of running, the cycling stories, you know. And got an injury, came back from Oregon with the intention to go back to Oregon. Did a bit of triathlon training to stay in shape. Injury didn't go away, but in that meantime, I found cycling. And it was, again, very apparent very early on that I was very good at it. But I was like, no, I'm a runner. I'm going back to Oregon. I'm a runner. Like, this is, you know, cycling's just, you know, just a bit of fun. And I don't know if you know Dave Sanders. He's sort of like this historic coach from Australia who looked after Simon Gerrans and Simon Clark and a lot of Australia's best cyclists. Cadell have come through Dave Sanders' Victorian Institute of Sport program. And he took me under his wing a little bit, brought me to a few camps where I sort of was racing up and down the climbs with sort of Rob Powell, Lucas Hamilton, guys like this, and sort of doing okay with them. And he sat me down at the end of one camp, and basically before that meeting with him, I was a runner, and after that meeting, I was a cyclist, and I was like, I'm going to be a cyclist. He said, you know, you have a massive opportunity to be a professional cyclist. And I remember saying to him, like, do you honestly believe that? And he said, yeah, I do. And that was good enough for me. And then I just turned my entire life around. I raced the Australian Under 23 Championships, which is my first ever race on the road. Finished 20th, I think. And there was a group of sort of seven that Caleb won from, and then another group of 15-odd that I was in. Baden Cook saw me, spotted me, sort of sent me straight over to Chambéry, which where we first sort of made contact at the AG2R under 23 team. So that was my first really season on the road in French Division 1 racing. And looking back, that was a big task to take on. Didn't speak a word of French, living in a team house and just getting on with it, super passionate, motivated. And there was rough times, but I got through that year. Wasn't any sort of massive results to speak of, but it wasn't bad, to be honest. And then I went to Seg Racing, which I really struggled with. I struggled with their mentality and their ways of doing things. Obviously a massively successful team at the moment, but for me it just didn't work. A bit like Gabs Kulick, you know, just sort of butted heads and was unhappy there, to be honest, and had a lot of issues with sickness. And so yeah, I had a rough year at Seg, and that was my last year under 23, so I was in a bit of trouble, to be honest. No one really wanted to take me on, and Robbie and I stumbled upon Kahara, the development team there, which was super amateur but super fun. I had a great year racing all these unknown races in Spain, and had a really good year, actually. I think I was like had 20 top 10s and finished third at one of the biggest amateur tours in Spain. And this is a system that like Contador, Rodriguez, Marc Soler has come through, and I don't think it's acknowledged enough, the Spanish amateur scene, because there's so many great Spanish cyclists, but these races are still super like Stone Age, like, you know, the way they run them, but the way they're raced, it's impressive. So I had a good year there, and still was in a bit of trouble at the end of the year, because I was trying to explain my results to a lot of teams, and they're like, look, we can't find these results, like, we don't know what you're talking about, you know, difficult again. And then ACA came along, run by Matt Wilson and Ben Kirsten, and I jumped on board with them a week before Sun Tour. A lot of people made that happen, and finished 10th at Sun Tour, which was at that time was the biggest result to my date. That was great. Morale was through the roof. Aqua Blue seemed super interested after that, and that was exciting, etc. And then yeah, had a good year with ACA. Finished 7th at Tour of Tajigia race in Japan. My teammate won that. I helped him win that. And then obviously Qinghai Lake was the biggest one, and, you know, sort of you hear all sorts of stories about Qinghai Lake. It's kind of got this massive reputation, and prepared so well for it. My coach Ben Day was just got me absolutely dialed for it. Yeah, Qinghai Lake was what it was. 9th on GC, and off I went with BMC.
Shoot à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Well, we interrupt the Freddie Ovett interview, which we'll return to in just a moment, but that was the voice of Seb Piquet, race radio at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this episode of the Cycling Podcast is sponsored by Harry's, the Razors people. Now, Richard, we've got our live event at the Clapham Grand on Monday night, so I trust at least one of us will be neatly presented, well turned out and cleanly shaven, and I'm guessing that's going to be you.
Yeah, what a responsibility, but one out of the three of us has to look decent. Don't we? So yeah, I'll be shaving with my Harry's razor on Monday, Lionel, and I've actually taken my relationship with Harry's a stage further by signing up to their shaving plan. So I now get my replacement razor blades delivered when I need them. How about that?
Wow. Well, all of our listeners can sign up and get a trial set for £3.95 by going to harrys.com/cycling. While I don't use the razors, Rich, because I'm a unshaven scruffball, as you well know, what I do like about the company is the ethos behind it, the fact that Jeff and Andy, who started the company, did so to try and provide top quality razors at cheaper prices for people, because it's one of those things, isn't it? I mean, it's one of the things that dissuades me from shaving is that just the relentlessness of it. You shave one day and then you've got to shave again the next day.
I thought you were going to mention the cost.
Cost as well. It just racks up. Imagine how much over a lifetime. So, you know, this is quite service.
I'd never thought of it like that, but I might have known you would.
Trust me to look at the detail and do all of the present things in the least favourable light to me. But no, I like the ethos behind them, that they bought their own factory and they're manufacturing their blades and delivering them to the customers at reduced prices. So if anyone wants to get a trial set with weighted ergonomic handle, 5 precision engineered blades with lubricating strip and trimmer blade, a rich lathering shave gel and a travel blade cover, get started shaving with Harry's today by claiming your trial set for £3.95 at harrys.com/cycling.
That's harrys.com/cycling.
Now back to you talking to Freddie Ovett, Rich.
Going right back. Your dad was a cyclist as well. I have vague memories of him doing time trials and so on in the borders. So when he was living in Scotland, I think he had an injury that made him turn him onto the bike. Is that right? Am I remembering that?
Yeah, I mean, I've heard stories and I've seen pictures of all these cool bikes that he was given, and I don't think he really remembers, to be honest. But I think
people around there remember him turning up and doing 10-mile time trials and things like that. These could be urban legends. I don't know, but
yeah, I'd love to speak to these people because I know what Dad's like. He just his memory's questionable at times, I'd love to hear. I can imagine he's probably rocked up to some of these 10-mile time trials, just absolutely destroyed everyone in like a horrific position, and just putting out an outrageous amount of watts. Just knowing Dad, but. Yeah, I don't know. I think he dabbled with duathlon triathlon because he was a terrible swimmer, but duathlon and cycling after running. Just, I don't know why he did that. I think just to keep himself occupied a bit, trying to transition himself out of this life as an endurance athlete. And I think he was quite good. And I think you're right. I think he had a bad bike accident.
He did, yeah.
Really bad. Someone opened their door on him, and I think that was the end of it. Yeah, I think. It can't, not only scared him, but it actually did some serious damage. So that was that.
Yeah, I do remember that, reading about that as well. Yeah. I think it was covered in the papers in Scotland.
Yeah. Coe is beaten surely. Ovett hits the front, and Coe can't get through. Steve Ovett coming home to take the gold medal for Great Britain to beat Sebastian Coe against the silver. Kirov gets the bronze.
And what was it like for you then? As a runner, as a promising runner, being the son of Steve Ovett, was that a positive thing, or was that a pressure, or did you not really feel that at the time?
It's a question I get asked a lot, actually, and I remember as a kid, I would just sort of play it off as not a big deal. I'd just be like, nah, I'm my own sort of man, and I'm doing my own thing, and yeah, he was what he was, but I don't know, looking back at it now as a sort of 8, 9, 10, 11, 12-year-old, competing at a high level, as high as you could at that age, I think it was, whether I liked it or not, the eyes were always on me. It was, I remember always I was introduced to the stadium as Steve Ovett's son, never Freddie Ovett. I didn't know any different, but in my mind it was like, I've got a massive advantage. Steve Ovett's my father, he's my coach. None of these guys have that. They all know that. It's got to be intimidating. But I think I used to worry myself sick before races. I remember my first national final when I was 10. We lined up. I was so horrifically sick of nerves before in the warm-up. I said to Dad, I can't do this. I'm in a state. And he said, hey, you'll be right. It's fine. We got on the start line, and I walked up to the start of the man with the firing pistol and said, I don't want to race. He said, what? I said, I don't want to race. I can't do this. And he sort of looked at me and kind of like laughed and said, okay, well, you're going to have to tell the sort of official over there. And I walked over to the official and said, I don't want to race. And they said, all right. Race started. Dad was at the back straight and he was looking through and he's like, fuck's Freddie. And I was walking across the infield and I just couldn't do it. And I think when you look at that and what a terrible experience for a 10-year-old kid to go through, we flew to that race. We flew back to it. And yeah, I got better. I actually won the national championship that following year, but I think I remember when I did win a race, which was pretty much every race I did at that age, it was relief. It wasn't really happiness. And for a 10, 11, 12-year-old kid, I don't think that's healthy. And that wasn't my dad's fault at all. My dad was the most relaxed, supportive, honest coach and sort of mentor I could ever ask for. That was just me, and that's the type of person I am. I put everything into everything I'm doing. And yeah, I dealt with it. I learned to deal with it. But yeah, I if I compare the feelings before a cycling race to the feelings before an athletics race when I was a kid, it's just incomparable.
Regardless of, you know, how he was, were you doing it for your dad, do you think? Were you doing it rather than for yourself? Do you think you were doing it for him?
Yeah, I mean, there was obviously a massive legacy, and everyone would, you know, everyone was saying, oh, he's following in his dad's footsteps. But the problem is, like, I suppose it's similar to like Axel Merckx trying to follow Eddie Merckx. Like, the problem was, when it's okay if your dad was like a club runner and he was quite good, and but when your dad is still one of the greatest middle distance runners of all time, it's like, wow, like, you've got some fucking big shoes to fill. And you take that on as a kid. You're like, yeah, I can do it, you know, why not, you know? And every year I'd sort of compare my time to his best time at that year, and I'd always be a little bit behind, and, you know, and he would always say, you've got to stop doing that. It's, you know, it's not healthy. And he was right. And I was never doing it for him, but I obviously was massively invested in the story and like how cool it was. And it was super cool that Steve Ovett's kid's running actually really well, and maybe it will eventuate into something. And that's exciting. But
did you used to, you know, have YouTube in those days, maybe? Or maybe you did, I don't know. You're much younger than I am. But
yeah, no, I know.
Not when you were 10, maybe, but did you go back and read and watch his old races?
Yeah. I know more about Dad's history than he does. Like, honestly, like, I'm not even joking. Like, there's been times where I've actually had to correct him. Like, no, you didn't run that time. You ran this time. You didn't. You won this race in that time. And he's like, oh, really? I'm like, yeah. And I know it. You know, because I am still a massive fan of athletics. You know, and I think. Sounds a bit like cheesy, but if I wasn't Steve Ovett's son, I think I would have been a massive fan of him and his aura, the person he was, and the way he raced. He was cool. He was a rock star, you know. And yeah, still to this day, incredibly proud that he's my old man.
Well, we, you know, in Britain, people still talk about there being two camps. You were Seb Coe, Steve Ovett.
It was a special time to be alive, by the sounds of it. And you know, and as a fan of athletics, I would have loved to have been around, but I obviously can't because I'm his kid. You know, those days are gone in athletics. You don't have those sort of stories anymore, and especially in Britain, to have two characters like that, it's, you know, as a journalist, you can't write that sort of script because it's just so implausible. But it actually happened, and it happened in such a way that just every race, every world record, every comment just absolutely threw wood to the fire. And as an athletics fan, like, what a time to be alive.
So when you made the switch and became a cyclist, how did your mindset change? Was it a sort of liberating feeling in a way? You were coming out the shadow of your father and doing something for yourself?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, I think a little bit that comparison could no longer be made. And with cycling, there was a lot less people aware of who my dad was, you know. And I think without me kind of knowing it, it was a lot more relaxed. There wasn't sort of results and times, etc., to be compared to, so I was kind of just doing it myself. And yeah, maybe that was a big part of my success.
Has your dad become interested also in cycling and obviously following your career and getting to know some of the weird aspects of this sport and the way that it's organised?
He's a fan of cycling. He's not a fan of athletics. He never really has been. He doesn't turn on to watch the Monaco Diamond League because he just couldn't care less about, you know, whoever's doing well there, which is, I think, it says a lot. But yeah, cycling, he's you know, he would say, oh, did you see Sagan, you know, won that stage, or did you see, you know, what happened with Froome and Geraint? Like, couldn't quite work. And we talk about it, you know. And he's a fan of cycling, and he's pretty up to date with how it works, because let's be honest, it's a horrifically complicated sport to understand from an outsider. And yeah, he came and watched me at Sun Tour and had an absolute ball doing that. That was pretty special to race well in front of him there. And
you're a rangy guy. You're a climber, aren't you? You're a good climber. Yeah. How, you know, over the years you've been in cycling, you came to it pretty late. At the Vuelta just now, we saw another ex-rider, Michael Woods, an ex-runner, Michael Woods, who came to the sport late as well, finally start to get the results that he's... You know, do you feel, having come to it late, you're still learning, you're still developing, and there's still, you know, improvements to be made?
Definitely. I mean, I think no matter if you've come from a different background or not, I think every year you do learn something or you do get a little bit stronger. And I think everyone's like, oh, when I speak to teams, they're like, oh, how old are you? I'm like, I'm 24. And they're like, 24. And I'm like, yeah, but I started cycling at like 20. So my cycling age is probably one of the youngest in sort of compass of people who are doing what I'm doing. And every year, physically, I see actually a massive improvement, which is exciting. But yeah, experience, it's still like... That's still a sort of decade project, I think. You know, stepping up and racing with a BMC, it's just like that's another level. It's like you think you've learned quite a lot racing at continental level, and then you go into Vuelta, it's like, wow, like there's a lot to consider. And that's why you know, in this tough situation right now, we're trying to find a place in the team. It's like there's no way I can throw in the towel now. You know, there's just a massive long journey ahead, and got to be invested in that. It's easy to sound hard done by, but you know, it's cycling. It's a not really a structure in place where if you do this, you get this. It's team-based support, you know, and there's a lot of luck involved in picking up a contract, and it's tough, but yeah, you know. So sitting at an office for 8-9 hours, you know, hoping you're going to get a raise or, you know, get a promotion, you know, like, you just got to keep at it. So, yeah. That's where I'm at the moment. Yeah.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. You can still get 25% off all your Science in Sport products at scienceinsport.com with the code SISCP25. Now, this week's question for the Science and Sport experts comes from Nathan Pedley. Hi, guys. The next time you get to ask the nutrition guys at Science and Sport a question or two, could you ask them about caffeine strategies, please? I do a lot of short, fast rides of about an hour and a half and longer rides of 4 hours plus. And currently I use caffeine before I ride for an hour and a half and then halfway through the longer rides. To accentuate the benefits of this, I go caffeine free at all those times, much to the annoyance of all my family and friends when I shout decaf every time I ask for a cuppa. My question is for longer rides still. To do my longer endurance rides, I have to start really early and usually at stupid o'clock. I'm a bit groggy to say the least, and if the first part of the ride doesn't go well, then it's rare that caffeine rescues my ride. Would it be better to perhaps have a steady intake of caffeine throughout the longer ride, or to use the larger hits of caffeine at intervals throughout the ride? Hope that's a clear enough question. Many thanks. Keep up the good work, Nathan. Over to Ben Samuels at Science and Sport.
So caffeine is perhaps one of the most researched ergogenic aids in sport nutrition and investigated in a number of contexts, be they related to overall exercise performance or specific substrate utilisation during sessions. For this question, we're potentially looking at the effect on time to exhaustion and the longer endurance effort, where caffeine ingestion during exercise has shown performance benefits in the latter stages. This is potentially due to a reduction in fatigue and perception of effort. With a longer endurance ride, say 6 hours plus, and you're having to be out of the door so early, a practical approach to the ride could be to have a low-dose caffeine option before you go out, maybe a coffee alongside breakfast to provide that stimulatory effect. Then plan to have a single efficacious dose of caffeine a number of hours into the ride. You're probably looking at a couple of hours before you're due to finish, having that caffeine ingestion to really give you the greatest performance benefit.
Thank you very much for that, Ben, and I hope that was helpful, Nathan. Now, we've been listening to Freddie Ovett. That interview was done a few weeks ago, so to bring the story up to date, I caught up this week with Freddie on the phone to find out how his final few races with BMC went and how the rest of his season has gone. He's still racing, in fact, finishes this weekend. I also just caught up with him to ask about what he's going to do in 2019 and beyond.
So basically, after I saw you, I had four more races with BMC, and they all went really well. It was actually the first time I raced with BMC without any issues, without obviously the crash in Utah and being sick after that in Germany. And So yeah, it was exciting, and Italy went well. I raced first Milan Torino, and we had Dylan Tuns and DeMarchi in the team who both went really well in Emilia a few days beforehand. So yeah, I was riding in support for them. So yeah, that was a good weekend of racing, and stood me in really good stead for Japan Cup, which is a really good circuit for me. And yeah, I went Japan Cup with Nico Roach, Alberto Bettiol, Simon Gerrans, his last ever race, which was quite a big deal to be a part of. And yeah, had an absolute blast in Japan. Like, I've been to Japan twice now, and yeah, it was unreal. We just had so much fun. The people were great. The food was great. The hospitality, the races were fantastic. The crit was super fun. And in the road race, yeah, I actually had a bit of support from the team to, along with Nico Roach, to sort of get stuck in and try and contest the finale. And I finished in the second group in the end, fighting for 7th or 8th place. I kind of messed up the sprint, which was a bit annoying. It would have been nice to get a top 10, but I finished 15th in the end, and Nico was 4th. But yeah, it was nice to be up there and feel like I could have been right up there. Finished super positively with BMC on and off the bike. I was really happy with how the experience went, considering the unfortunate luck that I had at the start of it. And the management were also super happy with me, but for next year there's just simply no space, and that always was going to be the case. But I think for 2020, yeah, if I have another good year, something maybe could be worked out there, but nothing concrete, of course. Yeah, there's just hopefully something we can continue working on over next year. And now I'm, yeah, I've still trained after that, and I'm back with my Australian Continental team, Australian Cycling Academy, finishing the year with Tour de Okinawa in Japan, or a nice one-day classic on Sunday. And then after that, I go to Tour of Fuzhou in China, which is a five-day race with two mountaintop finishes, which suits me really well, and managed to still be in quite good form at this time of year. So I'm looking forward to them, and I'm looking forward to getting back racing with my Aussie outfit, and I always have so much fun with them. And yeah, hoping to finish the season on a high, actually. I'm really looking forward to see what I can do over there. I think I'll take a very short break after that and gear up for quite a busy January, I think, back in Australia, and hoping to do well at nationals and get selected for the national team for Tour Down Under, and go back to Sun Tour and hopefully have another good race there. So, yeah.
So that was a little update from Freddie Ovett. And before that, we heard the full interview that I did in Girona the day after the Vuelta finished, actually. So that was in the middle of his spell with BMC, and it started off very badly, but got better towards the end. And he remains cautiously optimistic that there might be a contract for him in 2020. He will be, he'll be 25 in January, so he's no longer all that young. But then again, he did come to the sport quite late. And with these guys, we've seen a few of them. Michael Woods being a great example of someone who came to cycling quite late from running. It can take them a bit longer to get to grips with some of the more technical aspects of the sport. So watch this space as far as Freddie Ovett is concerned. But an interesting guy and an interesting story.
Yeah, very much so. But I mean, I do wonder, it's a very commercial world, isn't it? It really is. It's capitalism writ large, professional cycling. And I wonder whether he would have had as many sort of opportunities and would still be kind of on the radar at the age he is if his surname weren't Ovett. I'm not trying to be unkind here or denigrate his abilities as a rider, but it's a real sort of dog eat dog world, isn't it? And getting a contract is not easy. A bit more of my sort of data analysis, looking at how many riders manage to stay in the sport after their initial 2-year contract. We've talked a lot in recent weeks about sort of the natural wastage of riders that slip out of the World Tour at the end of their first 2-year contract. And actually, thanks to Pro Cycling Stats, which I've been immersed in the last couple of days, I've managed to work out that of the riders who signed a Neo Pro contract in January 2017, and so therefore are coming to the end of that first contract now, 23 out of 30 are staying at World Tour level for next season. One has already dropped down to Pro Continental level, a couple have already dropped out of the sport completely, and four are awaiting a contract. So the notion that there's a scorched earth policy towards young riders once they've done their first couple of years is perhaps more feeling over fact, this year at least.
I think, Lionel, as we've mentioned a couple of times in the last few weeks, as we've discussed these young riders, a bit of a glut of riders this year who have found themselves looking for a new team. There are a lot of guys whose abilities are very similar and quite difficult to differentiate, and who are probably all capable of doing a pretty reasonable job as not winning races, but certainly as domestiques, even in World Tour teams. And often it's intangibles that do differentiate them. One rider who's attracted a lot of publicity, or two riders, Conor Dunn and Larry Warbass. We talked about the fact that their no-go tour was very well. I don't think they did it cynically by any stretch of the imagination, but it was a very useful tool to keep them in the public eye at a time when they were looking for contracts. But also, I think maybe more to the point, a point more applicable to other riders. We've seen with Larry Warbass what an important role relationships can play, and would he have got a contract with AG2R without a pre-existing friendship with Romain Bardet? Probably not. And the same goes obviously for the period that some of the riders spend as stagiaires. A lot of it can be to do with how they interact with teammates, how well they're liked within the team environment, and also just being ready and healthy. And it was unfortunate. It sounds as though it was very unfortunate for Freddy Ovett there that the start of his stagiaire period with BMC coincided with a period of ill health. But the life of a professional cyclist and the job of a professional cyclist is essentially to be ready and able to perform a lot of the time, and consistency of health as well, and being ready to do that sort of fairly bog standard job of just finishing races is absolutely essential, and that is often what will differentiate two riders of very similar talent.
Just going back to your point about his name, Lionel, I'm not sure that the Ovett name would carry much weight in professional cycling, certainly beyond the initial flicker of recognition, but I'm not sure it would earn him a pro contract. I think especially when you're talking there about just doing the job, Daniel, that's the reality for most professional riders. It's about doing a job, and clearly, as we heard in his update there, that's what he did, and did quite well in his last few races with BMC there. And going back to another point that one of you made, I can't remember who now, but we spoke recently, Lionel, didn't we, to Adam Blythe, about who is going back to Lotto Soudal with James Shaw, a much younger rider, having lost his place there. And Blythe was making the point that the trick to keeping a long career as a pro cyclist, if you're not one of the big winners, is to be really good at something. To have something that you're really, really good at, rather than being an all-rounder or being quite good at everything. If there's one thing that you can do really well, and you can find the right team looking for that sort of rider, his thing is bunch sprints and helping a sprinter, Caleb Ewan, joining that team next year, of course, and he knows Caleb Ewan from Orica Scott.
To be fair, Rich, I was not saying that his name would earn him a pro contract, because I think if that was the case, he would already have one. What I was saying was it leaves the door open. People might think, well, his father was an Olympic champion. Looking at Michael Woods as well, I mean, he was an 800-meter runner, wasn't he? And, it leaves the door open a little bit longer. People might give more the benefit of the the benefit of the doubt, a bit more opportunity than, another, Belgian or French or Italian rider. I don't know.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, do you not think that's also because you think that the genes might have passed down, the athletic ability, the engine might be
absolutely
there.
Absolutely. And presumably they've tested him and had a look at look under the bonnet to see whether he has that potential. So, yeah, of course. But
as Daniel says, there's a lot, there's a lot more. And luck comes into it too, of course, as well, in terms of health and falling off and all that kind of thing. It's a complicated business, isn't it?
Yeah. And we sort of put talent on a pedestal. We always talk about talent and physiological abilities. And now we're in a period where technology has progressed to the point where it's very easy to get empirical evidence for people's physiological abilities. You can see how many watts they put out and you can compare them, and it will be very easy to just draw up sort of league tables of who can produce the most watts and decide who you're going to sign, which riders you're going to sign that way. I was listening to an interesting interview the other day with football manager Thomas Tuchel, the PSG manager, who's been sort of hailed for a very good record with young footballers, and he said that the biggest thing that he looks for in young footballers is not talent, it's an ability to solve problems, an ability to find solutions. And I suppose that goes back to my point about being healthy and being ready to do whatever is asked of you at any particular time, and understanding that you're not always going to be at 100% of your abilities, but still finding a way, some way to do the job.
Well, that's what I mean. Hard work is a talent, adaptability and flexibility is a talent, and staying healthy is a talent. And when you talk to a lot of sports directors, which rider would you sign before he won the Tour de France, a lot of people would have said Geraint Thomas, and people might have raised the odd eyebrow at that because they wouldn't do now, of course. But one thing about Geraint Thomas from the whole of his career is that if you said to him, right, you're racing in Germany this week and then Australia the week after and then Denmark the week after that, he would he probably wouldn't bat an eyelid. He'd say, okay, that's what you want me to do.
Oh, go and do your Geraint Thomas impression here, Lionel. You do a cracking Geraint Thomas
impression.
I'll tell you what I'll
do.
Shall we save it for next week?
For the pre-Christmas episode. But we should probably. What is difficult, what is not a talent, is my research ability, because I can't find out which race Geraint Thomas rode for Saunier Duval. I found an interview with him from Pez Cycling News in which he says it was the Tour of the Basque Country. Well, it can't have been that because that's at the wrong time of year. The Pez Cycling News say it was probably the Vuelta a Burgos. Geraint Thomas says Iban Mayo won it. I'm thinking that it wasn't the Vuelta a Burgos because he's not on the start list of that race in 2006. But I've got a funny feeling it might have been the Subida Urkiola race. Is that a one-day race in the Basque Country, Daniel?
I think at one time it was a two-day race and it became a one-day race.
But this mystery...
Or possibly vice versa. So in 2006, Iban Mayo won the general classification of Vuelta a Burgos. It could well have been Vuelta a Burgos, except he wasn't on the start sheet.
He wasn't, exactly.
But Geraint Thomas.
But that was the right time of year. It was
Iban Mayo would have been a teammate at the time as well. He was Sonia Duval at that time, wasn't he?
Correct. I think...
just before disappearing.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to leave this to Ace Detective Richard Moore.
I'll find out tomorrow. Well, it sounds like Geraint Thomas might not have the answer, given what he said in the past.
I think
anyway,
it was at Urkiola. I've probably butchered the Basque pronunciation.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure Geraint Thomas will know the answer to this one. But anyway, I'll do my best. Just on the subject of Iban Mayo, there's a guy who retired and there were various rumours about what had happened to him. I'm going to just mention the Final Friends special of 2018, getting ahead of myself there, still to come out. That'll be out in a couple of weeks. It's a special on retirement, and it is an episode inspired by one of our friends. We opened a little competition to our high doning? We opened a little competition to our... friends of the podcast who donated the maximum amount to become a friend of the podcast, and thank you very much to them. to submit ideas for a friend's special. And we picked a winner, and in conjunction with him as guest editor, we have put together an episode that focuses on retirement. It'll end up being quite long, a two-parter, but it'll come out in the next couple of weeks or so. So stay tuned for that. You can still become a friend of the podcast for 2018 at thecyclingpodcast.com, and that will gain you access to all of the friends specials that we've put out in 2018. We will be opening up the Friends of the Podcast scheme for 2019 quite soon as well. We've got some good episodes to start that off. How many Friends specials have we released in 2018, Lionel? Because we promise a minimum of 11.
Oh, we've exceeded that by a great number. Remember, Kilometre Zero at the Giro d'Italia were exclusively for Friends of the Podcast. We've released at least 13 or 14 feature-length episodes and quite a few shorts, plus the Espoirs diaries. We've massively over-delivered, I have to say.
Yes, indeed. Before we go, we're doing our show next week at the Clapham Grand. That's sold out. Looking forward to seeing lots of you there. We'll be with Amara Terra, the band who do our music at the Giro. And on the 27th of November, there are a few tickets left for our show in Cardiff at St David's Hall. If you go to thecyclingpodcast.com, live events, you'll be able to get a ticket to that. To play out this week's episode, we're going to hear a clip from a show that we did earlier this year in Edinburgh. It starts with a reading by Lionel from our book, A Journey Through the Cycling Year. And then there's a story from Francois Tomaseau about how the Giro almost started in Marseille and how he was solely responsible for the rumour that that might happen. And it's quite entertaining. Our book, A Journey Through the Cycling Year, is available in all the usual outlets. It's also available as an audiobook in the US as well. Great Christmas present, the physical book, if you want to buy it in a bookshop or on Amazon and other places. That's A Journey Through the Cycling Year. But in the meantime, and before we hear this clip from our live show earlier this year, goodbye, Lionel.
Thanks, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Goodbye, chap.
Lionel, I think this is an excerpt from your diary Giro.
This is from the Giro, yeah, the Giro d'Italia. It's from week two of the Giro. Tricky to do two things at once. I mean, I normally
reading
can't manage
reading and speaking.
That. Yeah. so...
Reading, speaking, and critically appraising your work at the same time as you admitted that you did last time.
Reading my own work and realising...
You want me to hold your book or something?
No, I can hold my book and read. So this is Thursday the 18th of May, stage 12 of the Giro from Forlì to Reggio Emilia, 229 kilometres. The stage winner was Fernando Gaviria. The pink jersey was Tom Dumoulin. Forlì has a large, attractive, arcaded square. I think it's probably my favourite large, attractive, arcaded square of the Giro yet, so I pull up a chair outside a cafe and order a coffee. I spot Bahrain Merida's mascot, Falco the Falcon, a man, I presume, in a cartoonish bird costume, standing around waving at children. I'm perhaps reading too much into the poor bird's body language here, but he, or she, has the slumped shoulders so often seen among the poor convicts of the publicity caravan by this stage of the race. I suspect Falco is finding out just what a test of endurance the Grand Tours can be. There was going to be a joke in here about the occupant of the suit observing some kind of punishment, but the Bahrain regime has such a terrible sense of humour about these things that I'll direct you instead to the country's Amnesty International report. I take a sip of my caramel mochaccino topped with whipped cream. If Daniel was here, he'd be wincing at this stage. And muse that all teams in the World Tour should have a mascot. Of course, Sky's mascot would be a robot with a range of pithy phrases to help motivate the riders. Great cycling, G, it would say in a metallic tone. Watts, high. Margins gained, 4. In the afternoon, we arrive in Reggio Emilia, which sits in a sweet spot of northern Italy that seems to be home to just about everything that's great about the country. Reggio Emilia is where Parmigiano Reggiano cheese comes from. Just up the road is Parma, famous for the ham. And the same distance in the other direction is Modena, home of balsamic vinegar, Maserati cars and panini stickers.
On our way into town, we passed the Mapei Stadium, where Serie A team Sassuolo play. The club is the latest passion of Giorgio Squinzi, whose previous plaything was the formidable Mapei cycling team that straddled the turning of the millennium like a colossus. You can't see this, but there's a lovely picture of some Parma ham on the bottom of the page there. And on the other page, there's a lovely picture of our Maserati. The buffet laid on for the press is fabulous. There's a huge wheel of Parmigiano Reggiano to hack at, delicious slices of moist ham, and a glass of fizzy red Lambrusco, a wine that has a terrible reputation in Britain because everyone associates it with being cheap and unpleasant. But the red is a revelation, and I later discover that the local producers can't give the stuff away to the British, which puzzles them seeing as we guzzle so much Prosecco. I think back to last year's Giro when we stayed up in the Friuli region. Our hotel owner was all linen trousers and moccasins, bouffant hair and a self-satisfied tan. And although I couldn't understand what he was saying, Daniel explained the gist, which was that he thanked all the Brits for buying up every drop of his Prosecco, even the stuff he wouldn't wash his sports car with, so that he could afford to buy another chunk of the village. The stage is won by Fernando Gaviria. It's his third victory of the race, which is his Grand Tour debut, remember. And as he struts into the press room, he has the air of a young man who has just sold a vast quantity of really terrible Prosecco to a British importer for an inflated price and knows he has much more where that came from.
And there's rumours that the Giro will start in Marseille, perhaps even as early as next year. Francois is a resident of Marseille. Can you confirm or deny?
I should confirm. I'm not going to deny yet, but it's a funny story that because you might have, if you're a cycling enthusiast, you might have heard last week that the Grand Départ of the Giro maybe in 2019 could be in Marseille. It's a story I made up completely. But It started in a little restaurant in Marseille that somebody on the front row here knows well, called Les Buvards, and it's a place where you drink, you eat cheese and meat and ham and stuff. And at the end of the dinner, there was a guy there working for the Marseille town hall, and as you know, there was a stage in Marseille in the last Tour de France, and he said, could we do something, what could we do about cycling in Marseille to make it spectacular or something? And It really came out of the blue. I said, the Grand Départ of the Giro. And he said, oh, that sounds like a good idea. And so I played up the guys from the municipality. I sent a text to Mauro Veni, the Giro director. He said, oh, yeah, sounds good. And by and large, I managed to talk to a few politicians in Marseille, to play them against the other, to try and make sure they talk to Mauro Veni. And in a matter of weeks, it was all over the place. Mauro Veni came to Marseille. These guys met. I mean, all of a sudden, this crazy idea in a restaurant at the end of the evening became almost fact. And when I felt that it was going, that it was starting to go to be a little bit forgotten, it was during Paris-Nice, I decided I would leak the story to the press. So I did, actually. There was a friend there working for the local paper. I said, well, I have a little story for you. Maybe the Giro will start from Marseille in 2019. He said, you must be joking. I said, well, sort of. But and it ended up with a double page in a Marseille newspaper called La Provence, Giro to start in Marseille in 2019. So it was all over L'Equipe and all the French media. And actually, there's no actual facts in there, So in the age of fake news, I found myself, at the age of 57, after a long journalist career, making up news. And maybe when you make up news, they become facts. We'll see.